Hello, welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm in New York City, and earlier I spent some time at the Hayden Planetarium talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil deGrasse Tyson was born and raised in New York City, where he was educated in the public school system right through to his graduation from the Bronx High School of Science. He went on to earn his BA in physics from Harvard and his PhD in astrophysics from Columbia. He is the first occupant of the Frederick P. Rose Directorship of the Hayden Planetarium. His professional research interests abroad, but include star formation, exploding stars, dwarf galaxies, and the structure of our Milky Way. Neil is the recipient of 9 honorary doctorates and the NASA Distinguished Public Service Medal. His contributions to the public appreciation of the cosmos have been recognised by the International Astronomical Union in their official naming of asteroid 13123 Tyson. He has served on 2 separate presidential commissions on the future of the American aerospace industry and is the author of a number of books of popular science, including The Sky Is Not the Limit, Adventures of an Urban Astrophysicist, Death by Black Hole, and most recently Space Chronicles Facing the Ultimate Frontier. And last but not least, he is the host of the fantastic Startup Radio Show and podcast. Okay, so I'm in the American Museum of Natural History, sitting with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's the director of the Hayden Planetarium. So, Neil, thanks for talking to Little Atoms today.
Happy to do that. Are there Big Atoms? Is that another show, Big Atoms?
I'm aware of the tautology of the name, certainly. But no, Big Atoms is a sequel that we'll get to.
There you go.
I want to talk a little bit about the planetarium, but before we do, I want to talk about how you got here, basically, and I don't mean your commute to the office. You wrote a great memoir, The Sky Is Not the Limit, talking about how you got into astronomy and your journey here. So let's talk about that, first of all.
Oh, well, it wasn't so much a journey here. I had no designs on becoming planetarium director. I'm fundamentally an academic. So after my PhD in astrophysics, I postdoced at Princeton University, where you spend a few years where you don't have to teach, and it's just pure research, and you get to hone your skills a little further. But right about at that time, the American Museum of Natural History, to which the Hayden Planetarium is attached, was rethinking what the future might be in the astro department. And they knew I was homegrown and that I might have strong feelings about what the future of the Hayden might be. The Hayden Planetarium was my first night sky, as I say in page 1 of the memoir. And so I think they rightly and justifiably presumed that I would have some idea about what the future of Hayden should be. And so I gave them a long set of ideas, and they embraced most of them and ultimately asked me to participate in not only the reconstruction of the Hayden Planetarium, but I said, well, I'll do that, but only if you can promise that you can commit to a research department in astrophysics. Because as an academic, I care more about that than I care about the planetarium. A little bit more. I mean, I care a lot about the planetarium, but a little bit more as an academic. I'm culturally an academic more than I am an educator. And so they would ultimately agree to that, and so now we have both. We have the planetarium and a full research department in astrophysics. We have 14 or so PhD scientists working here in these floors where we're conducting this interview.
Let's perhaps talk a little bit about the research department. Then your own background is in stellar formation and the evolution of stars and galaxies and stuff. So perhaps tell us a little bit about that, first of all.
Well, I just happen to like things that change. The problem in the universe is when things change, they don't necessarily change on a human timescale. But fortunately, you have a gazillion objects to observe. That's an official number, of course, a gazillion. And when you have that many, you get to find some stars in the act of being born, others living out their lives, still others in their death throes. And so you can assemble a continuous picture of what a star does, even though you don't see a single star go through its entire life cycle. We simply don't live long enough to do so. But there are enough stars that are like each other so that you can make these very powerful inferences about what the life cycle of stars are. And the death part is fun because some of them explode, some turn into black holes, some do both, some just fade, some lose a lot of mass back into the galaxy. The life cycle of a star, I think, is one of the hidden fun secrets of the universe. And when you put all the stars together, you get a galaxy, and I like what galaxies do throughout their lives. And so those are my primary research interests.
What other things are people doing here then? Tell us about some of those other PhDs.
Over here, we've got people, one of my colleagues specializes in a particular kind of dying star, a star that has sort of repeated deaths. It's called a nova, where it explodes, but then it explodes again later on. So it's not finished dying. It draws it out. He's one of the world's experts on stellar novae. And Novi, it's from the Latin meaning new. In the old days, before people knew that that was a star about to die, it was just this bright thing in the night sky, and it was a new star to them. So it got the word nova. Now it simply means an exploding system. We have another one of my colleagues who specializes in discovering planets orbiting stars that are not our own star system, and or anything that orbits the star. They could be very dim other stars that don't show up in a normal telescope. He has special detectors and special apparatus to detect extremely dim objects in orbit around a host star. Someone else who's a theorist, a modeler, and he programs computers to simulate what goes on between the stars, the formation of stars, or anything that involves gas, actually, and movement of objects through gas.
Now, at this point in the interview, we have to pause briefly while Dr. Tyson answers a very important telephone call.
Sorry about that interruption. NASA called. NASA calls. I'm sorry, you got to wait for that call. We're setting up a phone call, a video call between me and astronauts on the space station. It's going to happen next Tuesday or Wednesday. And it's in the service of the mental health of the astronauts, actually.
Sure.
So the astronauts have certain things that they bring with them that they're allowed to do that gives them a comfort level, even though they're away from home and they're in an exotic, strange, you know, sensory-deprived environment, right? They still get to do some normal things, like just have a conversation with somebody from Earth. So that's what we were setting up. Sorry for that interruption. So my other colleague specializes in object and clouds, gas systems, and how gas reacts to gravity, how it reacts to magnetic fields, how it reacts to collapse and when it forms stars, how it reacts to stellar explosions. That's a very important, very complicated area in astrophysics, because gas is not just some solid object that you can move around. It has shape, and it has a different shape, and it has properties within. It takes very high-performance computers to field those. And so we have graduate students and postdocs and this sort of thing. Someone else cares about extremely dim stars that are very nearby, stars in our solar neighborhood. They go by their motion, because they're so close by, they move by your field of view very quickly. So there's some of the fastest-moving stars in your field of view that exist out there. And so he's completing the catalog of the very nearest stars to the sun. So we've got people just all in and out of the galaxy, and it's a nice, it's a vibrant community here.
Let's talk a little bit about the Hayden Planetarium as an adjunct of the Natural History Museum then, so as a public planetarium.
It's one of countless planetariums in the country. It's one of the largest, but when you just add up all the planetariums, there are school planetariums, small towns have planetariums, museums have planetariums, and it's one of the simplest ways to bring the physical sciences to the public. Think about it, what does the physicist do? They don't really give tours of particle accelerators. I mean, they could, but then what are the people looking at? And you have to explain it. Here you just put up the night sky. Yes, we have explainers, but really, when you're looking up at the night sky, you know it, you feel it. You see the planets and the stars and the galaxy. For many people, it may be their first encounter with science at all in any kind of organized way. So here, when we rebuilt it 12 years ago, we completely digitized the entire, most of what we would show in there, and that allows you to access data from any part of the universe. It's not just the night sky. We can take you to the center of the galaxy or to the center of another galaxy or some other part of the universe. We limit it only by the sources of data, not our capacity to project it or to represent it. Now, to show it in an interesting way, we have science artists who understand the data and capture it in a way that is particularly moving to the visitor. So it's not just, we're not just showing you the universe, you become a participant. You become a navigator in the three-dimensional space of the universe, four-dimensional space of the universe, not only where you are in place, but where you are in time. In some ways, the planetarium was the very first virtual reality experience, because you walk into a dome and it transports you. And so we're just taking that to the next logical step.
You mentioned before about, you know, the people come in and that they get their first glimpse, first real glimpse at the night sky in a big city, and how affecting that is. And indeed, you said yourself, perhaps slightly scarily spiritual way, that when you first looked at the sky, the universe spoke to you and you knew that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, I had no choice in the matter. It was like, you will study the universe. I didn't quite use those words. I don't think it was in a feeling more than a literal command. But yeah, I came out of there hooked on the cosmos at age 9, by the way, very early.
You talked about you're a research scientist first and, you know, an educator second. But you are most well known as being a public promoter of science.
Oh, of course. And I'm not shying away from that title. I'm just saying culturally, emotionally, intellectually, I think of myself as a research scientist, even if, like right now, 80% or more of my time is given unto bringing the universe down to Earth for the public. But I will always defer to an educator who's out there, who's actually studied the cognitive difference between a 12-year-old and an 18-year-old, or who's thought about the science standards that have been written by the National Science Foundation. There are people who do that professionally, and I applaud them. I tip my hat to them every day. Many of them, they're in the trenches with especially like middle school kids, right? Age 11, 12, 13. That's got to be, those teachers should get awards every year for just even agreeing to do that. And I sit here and I show up in front of a camera lens, and you know, so my job is easy compared with those who have to think about the educational process daily, and I don't ever take that lightly.
I raise this because I want to talk a little bit about Carl Sagan, who I know is a huge influence on you. He's also the reason why I'm here talking to you, because he's the reason why I started this program. And of course, Sagan famously suffered in some ways at the hands of his colleagues because of his devotion to the public pronouncements about science.
Yeah, so I was interested in the universe long before I even knew anything about Carl Sagan. So his influence on me was not an influence on my interests, although countless thousands, possibly millions of people would credit him for their interest in the universe. Mine came earlier than he had come on the scene. His influence on me was primarily as a figure who carries with them some accountability and responsibility for not only passing a torch from what came before you to what will follow, but also there's kind of a caretaker of a certain public trust that you will communicate accurately, clearly, non-condescendingly, the discoveries of science to a community of people who, at the end of the day, actually paid for those discoveries. The National Science Foundation, NASA, the National Institutes of Health. You look at the research that's done on so many campuses across the land, it's funded by tax-based sources. And so one should not shirk the opportunity to, is that the right word, to shirk an opportunity, to take on that accountability. And I've done that, I believe. And yeah, there was some stress points. He was the first to do this in a big way, in a meaningful way, in a way that transformed how people thought about science. There was some jealousy in there, surely, but part of it was just, we don't do things that way, right? And that's an understandable, if not justifiable, emotion that we all have about something that you've done the same way for decades, or in those cases, for generations. He would appear on talk shows, on television. It's like, a scientist on a talk show? How could you possibly stoop to those steps? So because he came before me and others, now I'm on a field that he cleared. And with only minor tweakings in my conduct versus his conduct, I can say that my field has matured past those petty attitudes, primarily because in the end we recognized that if the public likes what we do, then Congress likes what we do, and then funding will flow in ways under those lights that it would not have otherwise flowed. And so, but I don't see that in all fields. The physics community and geology, geophysics, I see their popularizers not getting the respect that popularizers in my field now get. So, yes, yeah, somebody had to do it first, and the people who do things first in this world, there's almost always blood on the tracks. Almost always. But if you're driven by what you know is right, in the end, you get rewarded for it. And so there's a Carl Sagan Fellowship given by NASA. Carl Sagan, Edwin Hubble, and Albert Einstein. These are the three fellowships, right? So I think we've kissed and made up as a field. And I've, like I said, I'm at worst, it's neutral to my professional standing. And that's all I really cared for it to be.
Let's talk then about perhaps, does the public like what you do? Let's talk about the appetite for science and astronomy.
It's huge. It's huge. And I don't take credit for that. I think it's there. All I do is help people reveal that interest that they have deep within them. And nowadays, compared with when the original Cosmos series came out in 1980, nowadays you don't have to channel surf for very long before you'll stumble on a science program. Could be on life on Earth or evolution or the Big Bang or search for life or dark matter, black holes. Back in the days of Cosmos, Cosmos carried the entire burden of delivering the universe to the viewer. Now, multiple networks carry it. So I'm happy with what I see. And I believe I'm just, my read of this is I'm just playing into a pre-existing appetite, feeding people who are hungry.
But there's another side to America, of course. The other afternoon I spent an interesting few hours at the Creation Museum in Kentucky, and they have a slightly different take on the origins of life and the age of the universe. And so let's perhaps talk a little bit about where this comes from.
There's always been fundamentalists walking the streets, okay? Right, there's always been. We are a free, at least we still tell ourselves, we're a free, pluralistic country. Mm-hmm. Culturally pluralistic, religiously pluralistic, politically pluralistic. So I don't have a problem with people making creation museums. I have a problem if they believe that's science. There are museums on astrology. There are museums on mythology. There are museums on all kinds of things, on cultural belief systems. I mean, in this museum here, there's a whole area given unto what cultures of the world's believed, right? People believe all kinds of things. It seems to be fundamental to what it is to be human. So that's not even my issue. If you think it's science, then that is the beginning of the end of the role that science plays in the economic health of your country.
And they certainly do believe it's science. I was there to talk about creation science, something like intelligent design. These guys clearly believe that they're doing science as well.
Yeah, they're not. And so that's part of the problem. They don't see it as religion, they see it as science. And there are consequences to that. I'm not going to hit them over the head to tell them no. I will alert them of the consequences of this conduct. The consequences are you will breed an entire generation of people who will not actually know what science is. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they cannot enter the workforce in a way that will innovate tomorrow's economies, because innovations in science and technology are the foundations of economies. It's been the foundation since the Industrial Revolution. To the extent that you do not embrace those discoveries is the extent to which you are not a participant on that frontier. And these same people, I don't know if they realize that we have a bad economy and jobs are going overseas, and I don't think they understand or see the causes and effects of these phenomena. But maybe they one day will, because while no one wants to die, of course, in America, what's especially true is that no one wants to die poor. The connection between science, technology, engineering, and the health of your economy, it's not an obvious connection, but when it's made, it's an unforgettable connection. And maybe some of that needs to be put into the curriculum.
What can we do then to encourage more scientific literacy within the population? You talked about the education.
We're doing... I have a suggestion. You double NASA's budget. NASA is a force of nature unlike any other. When NASA makes a headline, it's headlines in every paper in the world. There aren't many fields of endeavor that can claim that. NASA has been so important that when America does things that other countries don't like, they'll still like NASA. NASA is almost a separate entity in the minds of the world than America. And it's touching, actually, because it means the people view NASA as reaching out to the universe that we all share. I hope I'm not over-interpreting what I think is going on in their heads. So, and that separates it from America. But, of course, it's a homegrown product. So it's a point of pride in America. If you double NASA's budget, turning the solar system into our backyard, where you can go to the asteroid and the moon and Mars and Jupiter and Europa, and then these discoveries are writ large in the daily papers, and people will see and feel and understand the correspondence between science and discovery and engineering innovations and economic strength. Once that's established, people will come flocking to the science classroom, wanting to learn more science, wanting to learn more engineering. In the 1960s, I'm sure these fundamentalists were still among us, but they had no place to stand. They had no audience because we were going to the moon. We knew that took science and math and engineering, and we were also in a Cold War, and you recognize the value of that kind of expertise when you're fighting a war, when you're trying to best someone in their technologies. So they might have been around, but no one would, if they had a place to stand, no one would listen, because they would not be making sense in a technologically driven culture where it's the scientist and the technologist that is inventing the tomorrow we all dreamt about, the tomorrow of the World's Fair. The World's Fair didn't define the 60s. The 60s defined the World's Fair. All the articles, the newspapers about the home of tomorrow, the city of tomorrow, transportation, it was all about tomorrow. We're in the middle of a Cold War, a hot war, a civil rights movement, assassinations, campus unrest. People are still dreaming about tomorrow.
You've actually served on a couple of government commissions looking at the future of the space industry, the US aerospace industry. So no doubt you suggested some of these things when you were on those panels.
It's hard. You know, moving government, it's like blowing on an ocean liner, thinking that you're going to change its direction. You can plant some seeds and maybe they tap root. But for me, my greatest benefit for being on these commissions was forcing me. the fact that being on the commission forced me to sharpen my thoughts and ideas on all of these issues. And that's what led to this recent book, Space Chronicles. It just came out just a couple of months ago. That's every thought I've ever had about our past, present, and future in space. And these commissions helped to not only expose me to how people think, so that if, as an educator, if I want to enlighten you further or differently, I know what pathways to take to get inside your head and say, you think that, but it's really this. Mm-hmm. It's not that. I understand why you think it's this, but it's not. Good example, you talk to the space enthusiast community, and they are angry with Nixon, President Nixon, for canceling the Apollo program. Got canceled under his watch. And they say, they assert that all we needed are politicians with vision, like Kennedy, and we would have been on Mars by now. It's like, no. No, you're being completely delusional. And you don't even know it. That's kind of what it is to be deluded, I guess. You don't know that you're deluded. If you knew that you were deluded, it's not delusion, it's something else. It's just a belief system that you have. We didn't go to Mars because the Soviet Union was not going to Mars. We went to the moon because the Soviet Union said they wanted to go to the moon. Now, we chose the moon as a target. Kennedy believed we could accomplish this in his own, under his watch. And it turned out to be the case, except, of course, he was assassinated. But we picked that goal because we were in contest with the Russians. When it was clear the Russians would not continue on to the moon, we stopped going to the moon. It's clear as crystal clear. It's got nothing to do with DNA. We have explorer DNA in us Americans. Or we can't be contained by... No, it's all fantasy. When we're no longer at war, the space ambitions stopped. And we have not been out of low Earth orbit since then, and that's been 40 years.
But that's an interesting illustration of what you said earlier about the whole world getting behind the journey to the moon, because although absolutely the Cold War was totally central to it, we don't tend to think that when we look back at it. We just think how great it was.
That's the cleansing of the memory.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go to Kennedy Space Center, Florida, there's a bust of him. And, of course, there's this quote saying, we will put a man on the moon before the decade is out. And you can hear his Brookline accent resonate just by reading the words. You hear him say it. And in that same speech, there's another part where he says, if the events of recent weeks, which is Yuri Gagarin had just come out of orbit, if we didn't yet have a vehicle that wouldn't kill you if it launched you in it. He said, if the events of recent weeks are any indication of the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere, then we need to show the world the path of freedom over the path of tyranny. Battle cry against communism. There was the driver, the war driver. The rest is just window dressing. Oh, let's go because it's fun to do and we'll explore. The history of exploration is that. Columbus was an explorer, but the folks who wrote the check were not.
Mm-hmm.
They had other objectives. Like, here, Chris, here's a satchel of flags, Spanish flags, to put them wherever you land and declare the land in the name of Spain. And while you're at it, find a shorter route to the Far East so that, you know, we can gain wealth because of this voyage that we're paying you to go on. They didn't say, oh, when you come back, tell the Academy about the flora and the fauna that you found. And what native peoples, can you draw them for? No, they didn't care. Didn't matter. So motivation matters, and an accurate understanding of that motivation will help you navigate what the future might be. Without it, you're barking up the wrong tree.
Let's say then, hypothetically, that tomorrow we double NASA's budget.
Beautiful thing.
We're going to try and promote this wonder of space again to the public. What do we do? Should we go to Mars? I want to sort of talk about
that. No, that's very destination-driven. No. I have an unorthodox view. You don't go into space with destination-driven motives. You say, space is my destination. Oh, scientists, you want to go to Mars? Okay, here's a strap-on rocket that'll get you there. Oh, is an asteroid coming? You want to deflect it? Here's another configuration. Go ahead. Oh, wait a minute. You want to mine that asteroid? Here's another. Oh, you want to mine the moon? You want to do a tourist drawn to the moon? There's a security need to get to Mars or to get to another asteroid or to get to the famous Lagrangian points where all the forces equal. I want to turn the solar system into our backyard. Therefore, it's not destination-driven. If you're destination-driven, then let's go to Mars. Then you get to Mars, and then what? That's what happened to the moon. We got to the moon. It's like, okay. Is there any plans to go to Mars? Nope. We said we're going to the moon, and by golly, we did it. So I want to promote the capacity to explore, not one destination versus another.
I want to just take us back a little step. We were talking about, we had a bit of a conversation about creationism, intelligent design, and a bit of irrationality there in the American populace. But it doesn't have to be It doesn't have to be the fundamentalists. People that believe in science and rationalism can also be a little bit irrational. I want to talk to you about one of the...
Yeah, just keep them out of the science class. I don't care what else happens to them.
Let's talk about one of the incidents, another thing that you've written a book about, which is the story of what happened with Pluto here at the Hayden Planetarium. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we were redesigning the planetarium. We demolished the original planetarium in 1997 and took the next 3 years to rebuild what is now the Rose Center for Earth and Space, containing the Hayden Planetarium. And so when we were designing the exhibit on the solar system, we knew, we're thinking this up in 1997, just 2 years earlier, another object had been discovered in the outer solar system beyond the orbit of Neptune. It was small, like Pluto. It was icy, like Pluto. It had an orbit kind of tipped out of the plane of the solar system, like Pluto. The thing smelled like Pluto. And there was some hypothesis, there was some suggestions that there'd be more of these icy bodies in the outer solar system. So this group, led by Dave Jewett and Jane Liu, looked for more, and they found more. And then more and more and more. So now there are thousands. Mm-hmm. I forgot the last number, but 1,000 plus or minus. There's bound to be many, many more than even that. So we read the writing on the wall, and we said, well, maybe Pluto is one of this new class of object that now exists. So let's group it that way in the exhibit. Because Pluto is really puny. Mm-hmm. So we talk about the four terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, the four gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and the Kuiper Belt containing Pluto. It was that way for an entire year until a reporter from the New York Times was tasked to investigate this. Then it became a page one story. Pluto not a planet, only in New York. And then we got raked over the coals. I got hate mail from third graders. You know, my boss called me, the provost. What did you do? Did you do this unilaterally? He's all concerned. And, you know, 5 years later, the international community of astrophysicists would vote that Pluto needs to be reclassified, in that case as a dwarf planet. But we don't have to change what we do here. We didn't call it a planet to begin with. We just said it's this, we grouped them by category, by class of object. And that's a stronger pedagogical approach anyway. I don't want people counting planets. There's no science in the number of planets that are out there. But there is science in what are they made of, what are their properties, orbital properties, structural properties. So in the book, what I wrote, The Pluto Files, The Rise and Fall of America's Favorite Planet, in that, that's the book just preceding the current space book. In that book, it's a celebration of not only the demotion of Pluto, but the reaction of the public to that demotion. It's hilarious. One of my favorites is Pluto shown on a street corner with a beggar's cup, and little pencils in the beggar's cup, holding up a sign that said, victim of downsizing. Very cute.
There was obviously a bit of a controversy in the scientific community for a while that debate was going on. But it's fascinating that that it caught the public's imagination. Why were they so bothered?
Well, I devoted a fair amount in that book to try to understand why the public even cared. And I found that Americans care more than other people. Mm-hmm. And it's because Mickey Mouse's dog is called Pluto. And Pluto was first sketched the same year that Pluto, the cosmic object, was discovered.
And of course Clyde Tombaugh was an American.
Well, he's an American, although most people didn't know that fact. So I can't credit that. But I do credit the fact that when do you first learn about planets? In third grade, second grade. When do you watch cartoons? Second grade, third grade. And so Pluto the dog and Pluto the cosmic object have the same tenure in the hearts and minds of Americans. And so I think Americans got a little more attached to it than what was justified. But Pluto is a fraction the size of our own moon. I mean, there's no justifying this planet designation. Plus, I don't think people should count planets at all. Mm-hmm. So,
just to finish up then, we've mentioned Cosmos a couple of times during the talk. You're involved in a reboot of Cosmos.
Yes, so precisely, I'm going to host and be executive editor of a reboot of Cosmos. It's been 32 years. By the time it airs, it'll have been 34 years. It won't be airing on PBS like the original one. It'll be airing on Fox. Many people said, Fox, what do they know about science? I said, that's why we're putting it on Fox, because that whole audience will now be treated, if we do it right, I can use the word treated, to an encounter with the universe that it is our goal that they will never forget, and that be enlightened in some fundamental way, so that they will embrace the fruits of science rather than shun it or run away from it, and recognize that science is all around us. Science is a fundamental part of life. It's not some course that you took in school that the book is on the shelf and you never have to review it ever again. So, yeah, and I'm collaborating with two of the original principals. There's Andrew Yin and Steve Soter. The three back then were the two of them and Carl Sagan himself. Mm-hmm. Of course, he died in 1996. We have another fellow, Mitch Canold, who is a longtime person in media. So the four of us together, we looked around to find out what network it would best serve it, or vice versa, and we landed on Fox. And Fox is prepared to do whatever's necessary to get this to work.
And when can we expect to see it?
The spring of 2014.
Fantastic.
On the internet, there's some statements about 2013. Mm-hmm. There have been some delays, but we feel pretty sure we can make the 2014 limit.
That's fantastic. So something to look forward to there. I've been talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil, thank you for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. And grow your atoms, okay? I'm tired of talking to little atoms. Come back when you're big atoms.
I'm Annie Drian. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.